So welcome everybody here and there. May the content be with you, as we might say. And it's my pleasure to chair this session and day, I think. Our first speaker this morning is Peter Pagin from the University of Stockholm, and he's going to talk about two concepts of force, if I'm not mistaken. So the floor is yours, Peter.
No, you're not mistaken. Thanks, Jérôme, and many thanks to François and Marianne for putting up this very nice and important conference. What I'll be talking about today would be somewhat complementary to the topics that were discussed yesterday. We can join forces in trying to see how those relate in the Q&A, maybe. So here's an excerpt from a famous passage from Frege. It follows that the relation of the thought to the true may not be compared with that of subject and predicate. Subject and predicate, understood in the logical sense, are indeed elements of thoughts. They stand on the same level for knowledge. By combining subject and predicate, one reaches only a thought, never passes from sense to reference, never from thoughts to its truth value. One moves at the same level, but never advances from one level to the next. A truth value cannot be part of a thought any more than, say, the sun can, for it's not a sense, but an object. And Frege regarded judging as passing from the thought to the truth value. A judgment for me is not the mere comprehension of a thought, but the acknowledgement of its truth. Judging can be regarded as advancing from a thought to its truth value. Naturally, this cannot be a definition. Judging is something quite of its own kind and incomparable. So there are several problems with this Fregean view. First, if I incorrectly judge a thought to be true, then I don't pass to the truth value, since I pass to another truth value that it does not have. I don't acknowledge its truth, acknowledge being factive, because it's not true. So we can repair the doctrine by saying that in judging, I pass from the thought to its point of evaluation. At the point of evaluation, whatever it is, the thought then gets a truth value. And for Frege, there is exactly one point of evaluation, the world. So then it was more natural to just fuse the two, the world and the truth value, into one. In judging, then, I implicitly ascribe the thought to the world. But for the reasons that Frege gave, this cannot be predication. It must be something else. And secondly, if there indeed are several different possible worlds with respect to which a proposition can be evaluated for truth and falsity, what does it mean to pass to the truth value? There may be different values of different worlds. A judgment may lack a truth value if some presupposition or other is not fulfilled. But it's not within our ordinary conception of a judgment that it can be both correct and incorrect at the same time with respect to the same point of evaluation. So if an asserted proposition is evaluated at some worlds, they must all give the same truth value. And this is most easily achieved if the proposition is evaluated at exactly one world. But which? So here I borrow the term from John Perry, that of concerning, from the most prominently from the paper Thought Without Representation. So if an assertion is correct, simpliciter, just in case it's correct or true at some privileged world, then the assertion concerns that world. So it's overwhelmingly intuitive that when a speaker makes an assertion, whether it's correct or incorrect, depends on how things are exactly in the world in which the assertion is made. And that's the actual world, or at least it's the actual world from the perspective of the speaker. So that the assertion concerns the actual world seems to be the dominant view. For instance, David Kaplan says the following. If C is a context, then an occurrence of phi in C is true if and only if the content expressed by phi in this context is true when evaluated with respect to the circumstance of the context. So So the world of the context is the world where the utterance of I occurs, if asserted by the speaker, and the circumstance of the context is the pair of that world and the time of the context. So for Kaplan, then, it's the world-time pair of the context that is privileged. You could say that the assertion concerns that pair. This is for Kaplan then connected with his temporalism. Some propositions are time neutral, true at some times and false at others, in the same world. So as the temporal such as the temporal proposition that Theaetetus is sitting, true sometimes, false at other times. So a temporal proposition, which is a temporal Kaplanian content, is then a set of world-time pairs. And an assertion concerns the actual present pair. David Lewis, in Index Content and Context, right, proposed that sentences express centered worlds propositions. These are sets of pairs, WC, of a world, W, and the center, C. And the center is itself a pair, ST, of a subject, S, and the time, T, or Lewis' original location and the time. So when a centered worlds proposition, P, is centered on the subject, S, at the time, T, in the world, W, P is true, simpliciter, if and only if the centered world, W, S, T, is an element in P. But Lewis also had an idea about the act of judging centered contents. The attitude of judging, affirming a centered world's proposition is that of self-ascription. The subject ascribes to herself the property of being the subject center at the time center of a centered world that is member of that proposition. But since the centered world of the assertion is determined, we can slightly recast Lewis's view as follows. The speaker ascribes to herself the present time and the actual world the property of being an element in the proposition. So an assertion then concerns the actual present egocentric world. So to the extent that truth by default is truth in the actual world, moving from a proposition to its truth value is moving from a proposition to its truth value in the actual world. This is, again, related, a modification of Frege's view, quasi-Fregean view. It's closely related to Lewis's idea of self-ascription, and it's explicit in one of François's books, from which I quote now. A content is not enough. We need to connect that content with the actual world via the assertive force of the utterance, in virtue of which the content is presented as characterizing that world. On this view, judging or asserting is not a content operation, but a step of actually or applying the content, or applying the content to the actual world. So a general pattern emerges here. We can regard the force of an assertion as affecting the step from the content of assertion to the contextually given point of evaluation. If the content is a set of epsilon points, worlds, world-time pairs, or what have you, then the force of an assertion affects the step to the contextually given epsilon point. This characterizes force functionally. It plays the role of mapping a set of epsilon points as input to the truth value at the contextual epsilon point as output. The functional view is general in the sense of being neutral as to what the epsilon points are. The question is how this view connects with the standard views about force. So this is the topic or the question I will start to address. So we'll look at a couple of standard views about assertion, about what makes an utterance into assertion, notions of force then. So one of the dominant views, which I think has been the dominant family of views over the past two decades, is the idea of assertions as governed by dedicated norms or dedicated norm. So, and the standard notions of force of an assertion are very different from this functional notion that I mentioned. So, on the norm view, an utterance is assertoric just in case the unique norm of assertion applies to it. And the most well-known example proposed by Tim Williamson is the view that assertion is governed by the knowledge norm. As Williamson puts it, one must, colon, assert P only if one knows P. Another main type of account of assertion is that of appeal to commitments. This was an element of Searle's account, and it's also central in the account of Robert Brandom. So according to Brandom, an utterance is assertoric if and only if, by means of an utterance, the speaker achieves two different social results at the same time. Firstly, the speaker authorizes the hearer to claim anything that follows from what is asserted. And secondly, the speaker undertakes the responsibility of justifying the proposition asserted if challenged. A third main type of account is that of communicative intentions. Several authors, including Searle, Bach and Harnisch, and Francois, have provided accounts where intentions about the mind of the hearer were central. To quote from Bach and Harnisch, they say that a speaker S asserts that P to a hearer H if and only if S expresses the belief, one, the belief that P, and two, the intention that H believe that P. And expresses is a technical term here, and S expresses an attitude just in case S are intense, or reflexively intense, another technical term, the hearer to take S's utterance as reason to think S has that attitude. And finally, there are cognitive accounts. Cognitive epistemic accounts that focuses on the relation between the speaker and the content, and to some extent between the hearer, the utterance, and the content, without appeal to normative notions or indeed intentions. Like Jerry, 2010, myself, 2011, and some interpretations of Stolnecker, not Stolnecker himself. On my own account, an utterance is assertoric just in case it's prima facie informative. That's almost slogan format. It takes a lot to unpack it. But to the first approximation, as Chalmers usually put it, to be informative is to be made in part because it is true. Thus, for the speaker, the truth of a proposition is part of the reason for uttering the sentence that expresses it. It's different from the hearer, but we'll... I thought of leaving that out in this talk. So, in all of these accounts, it is in virtue of some mental state or act of the speaker that an utterance is assertoric. How can these types of mental acts connect with the functional account presented in the first section? Is there a connection at all? So I shall be arguing that there is a connection. I shall also argue that this connection suits some accounts better than others and some models of content better than others. Actually, after some changes I made the other day, I would like to weaken this second sentence here a little bit in the first part of it. But we can come back to that. So the basic connection that I propose there is comes through the link between content and causality. So a belief concerns its actual source of information. So if I believe something, that is concerned with what causes the belief. My belief that Biden won the election concerns the actual world because the causal sources of this belief are all in the actual world. Let's adopt the view that possible worlds are world histories. As such, worlds are causally closed. If an event X is the cause of an event Y, then X and Y are events in the same world history. If histories branch, there is genuine branching, splitting of histories, then it gets more complicated. Then the relation of being in the same world is not transitive. And this diagram here, both Y and Z are in the same world as X, but they're not in the same world as each other. They have a shared part, but it's not, they have also parts that are different. Let's say that what a belief or an assertion concerns is its domain. Then we can add the principle that an assertion inherits its domain from belief. That is, the world an assertion is concerned with is the same as the belief is concerned with that the assertion expresses in some non-technical sense, deriving from the belief. So this is, I propose, intuitively right, since worlds are, and it has some advantages. For instance, since worlds are causally closed, speaker and hearer are in the same possible world. I can't communicate with anyone in a different possible world. This guarantees that the world the speaker's assertion is concerned with will be the same as the world the hearer's resulting belief is concerned with. It also gives some, I think, intuitively right results for agreement and disagreement. So look at this depiction. We have a pre-election state, an election where Trump loses, and in the actual world, the thin red line here, Trump loses, and Hobbes says Trump lost. In a counterfactual world, Nob says Trump won. And compare that with the following. We had a pre-election state where it splits, and in the actual world, Trump loses. In the counterfactual world, Trump wins. Hobbes says in the actual world, Trump lost. Nob says in the counterfactual world, Trump won. In the first case, intuitively, there is disagreement. In the second, intuitively, neither agreement nor disagreement. So in the first case, the source of information is shared between the worlds of Hob and Nob. In the second case, it's not. In the first case, their beliefs are concerned with the same world, a shared world segment, and in the second, not. I think that's an intuition that supports this idea. So how does causality do as forging the link between the functional and the standard notions of assertoric force? In the case of informativeness and classical proposition, it works well. The assertion that P inherits its domain from the belief that P, which provides part of the reason for the assertion. Since the world is concerned with the actual world because the actual world contains the source of information, so is the assertion. But the theory says that an assertion is assertoric, that is the theory that I have proposed, if it is prima facie informative, and that's not the same thing. An assertion can be prima facie informative without being informative from the point of view of the speaker, if the speaker does not have the corresponding belief. So the connection is then at best indirect. We need to add an idea, a second idea, for instance, this one, the seeming idea. So if X seems to be phi, then X concerns C if and only if phi concerns C. So since the assertion is prima facie informative, what it prima facie gives information about is what it gives information about if it is informative. So the seeming to be informative inherits then the domain of it being informative, the domain of the belief. So that's an idea that needs to be added, and it becomes then somewhat indirect. Look at now communicative intentions. In the case of communicative intentions, it's also not immediate. Communicative intentions do not in themselves have any source of information, and therefore are not concerned with the actual world because of such a source. We can, however, again, make the application to causality indirect. We can say that an intention is realized only if what is intended happens because of the intention. It's not enough that it actually happens, but it must somehow be because of the intention, and that's a causal relation. Then intention in the actual world can only be realized in the actual world. Communicative intentions concern the actual world, since it's only in a temporal extension of the actual history that they can be realized. So with this extended application, with indirectness, there is an indirect link again. We can say something analogous about commitments, as we said about communicative intentions. So we can add the principle that a commitment can be lived up to only in the world where it is made. I don't live up to a commitment to phi made in a branch A by phiing in branch B. It must be possible that the commitment itself causes the phi. Hence, with an extended application of causality, an indirect link is forged here too. Then I come to norms, where I think it maybe is the weakest connection. So you could say that the speaker cannot comply with a norm unless the norm is in force. So that's, I mean, your action can conform or not conform to a norm, whether or not that norm is in force. For instance, my action now is in accordance or not in accordance with Swedish law, but the Swedish law, well, some of it does, but most of it does not apply to me when I'm here in France. So those laws I can neither comply with nor violate when I am here. So if the norm comes into force because of some event in the actual world, only conforming to the norm in the actual world can count as complying with it, for it must then be possible to conform to the norm because of its being in force. That would be the idea. So this requires a theory according to which it is in virtue of particular events that norms come into force. And with such a theory, an extended application of causality again forges an indirect link. So there is a general need of indirectness in application. So we've seen that for all four types of the theory, the fact that an assertion can lack the default property requires that the causality requirement must be applied indirectly. An assertion need not be caused by the right belief. An intention need not cause the realization. A commitment need not cause compliance. That's a failure in both directions. And a norm need not cause conformity. So in all cases, the idea of causality must be applied indirectly. In the first and fourth case, that for informativeness and the norm case, it's upstream, that is, the events that are connected within the same world is the assertion and something that happens before the assertion. When it comes to commitment and communicative intentions, it's downstream. It's from the assertion to what something that happens later. In the first three, but not in the fourth, the content of the assertion is involved in the indirect causal link. That's not so in the fourth case, if it only is concerned with the coming into force of the norm, that's what counts. So I'm actually, I have been rather quick. So, okay, so I have time for the last section here. So when it comes to force, all these different accounts require a certain extra connection, which makes the application of causality indirect. One can discuss whether that speaks against the proposal of appealing to causality, or whether that idea is so robust that one can judge the merits of the individual theories on its basis. But when it comes to the content side, the outcome is a little starker. Seeing the idea with classical possible worlds proposition, because of the causal closure of possible worlds, that lends itself well to an application of the notion of causality, but it's not so easily extended to other models of content. Temporal propositions do not seem to allow for the link between the two notions to be forged. Although the source of information for an assertion must be in the actual world, it is often temporally located before the time of the context of utterance. Hence, it's not because of providing the source of information that the assertion concerns the actual present world-time pair. Neither will, in general, communicative intention at the world-time pair be realized at the same pair. Similarly for commitments and norms. And what goes for temporal propositions goes a fortiori also for centered world proposition. So using causality and the causal closure of worlds, that speaks heavily in favor of staying with classical possible worlds propositions as opposed to the other alternatives as the contents of assertion, if you want to appeal to causality. To summarize then, so it is possible to forge a link via causality between the functional notion of force and standard notion. The link applies indirectly in all cases, but differently so. Only in one of these cases, well, that's something I should have changed. That concerned informativeness. It's not true of prima facie informativeness. I was a little too fast when I wrote that first. But for informativeness, it provides a direct link, but in all the four theories, the link is indirect. And one can then discuss the plausibility of the principles that make the connection, the indirect connection. The link via causality seems wholly inapplicable to some models of the content of assertion. So if we believe in causality as forging a link, also, if we think that the functional notion is worthwhile having, then that speaks heavily against these non-classical alternatives. So, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. So, I understand that we give priority to the local audience. And of course, you can also write your questions, I think. So discussion is open. Dilip, sorry, I can't see.
Thanks, Peter. I enjoyed your talk. I just had a question about how the story about causation works. So take a world that's exactly like the actual world up until some time in the distant future, and then maybe something different happens. And so suppose I have some belief right now that it rained last night, say. And then the question is, why is my belief about this world rather than, say, that alternative world? And I take it your answer is, well, because some event in this world caused my belief. But then I was, so I think I understand, but it seems like in that alternative world, I mean, I think our grip on how to identify events across worlds is not so clear, but I think in this kind of situation, it's pretty clear that whatever caused my belief in this world also caused it in that world. So it's the same, so as long as you think that events can exist in more than one world, I would have thought that whatever event caused my belief in this world also caused my belief in the alternative world. And so we have the same pair of an event and a belief, but as it were, my belief in this world is about this world, and my belief in that alternative world is about that alternative world. So I wasn't sure what if I was misunderstanding how the...
Yeah, okay, so the philosophy of time is not one where I have a lot of expertise. So the two models that I have been, the main type of models that I have been thinking of is that of a theory with genuine branching. And in that case, the two worlds we're talking about would share a common, the present where my belief is formed, that would be the same world, actually, and then they will branch into the future. So it would indeed be the same event, but it would also be the same world when the occurrence of the belief takes place. As opposed to that, you have the Lewis view, where we have not genuine branching, but we have a bundle of world histories that look exactly like up to some point and then start diverging. And then, since on Lewis's view, again, worlds are causally closed, and there is no overlap of any kind between worlds. So you can't identify events between worlds on Lewis's view. So I don't know if you have some maybe third model in mind, but on these two models, the problem doesn't arise, I think. Either it is exactly the same event, because it is the same world, or we have different worlds and the events are different as well.
I wasn't thinking that the question depended essentially on the counterfactual world differing with respect to the future. So suppose that the counterfactual world is just extremely similar to the actual world, but there's some minor differences in the history of the two worlds. Still, it seems like I could have had my belief that it rained last night. I could have had that belief. I could have had that very same belief, as it were, even in a world in which had a slightly different history. And it might have been caused by the same event.
Yeah, well, so you are thinking of, let's say, if you take the, if we go back, here. Take this. So what you're imagining then, I think, is a modification of the right-hand picture here. So you have an actual world where Trump lost, and maybe a counterfactual world where Trump also lost. So Hobbes says in the actual world that Trump lost, and Nob says in the counterfactual world that Trump won or that Trump lost. But in this alternative world, Trump also lost.
Yeah.
And so I would say that these are two different events then that may play
very similar, maybe qualitatively indistinguishable role as justification for Hobbes and for Nob.
And I think that since in this case these are different events because of belonging to histories where that differ in terms of which event happens in these worlds, they would be concerned with different worlds. So there again would be neither agreement nor disagreement in such a case. So, and I think your objection is that if we can't find what you say is first you want to identify the event, which I am disinclined to do, but secondly, you want to claim that if the situations are qualitatively identical, whatever justifies Hobbes' assertion in the actual world also justifies, in at least in an internal sense, Nob's assertions in the counterfactual world. And maybe that's right. Then maybe that's right, in which case one has to appeal to the externalist element that was there anyway from the start in appealing to source of information.
Okay,
thanks.
So thanks, Peter. Very interesting. So I'd like to know simply a little more on two counts. One, first, how do you, that was a problem for me in general, how do you extend the functional account of force to the other types of force than assertion? That's one thing. And then the same question about the connection between the functional notion and the other notions, when you extend to other types of force, how can you maintain, can you do the extension for the connection as well as for the functional notion?
No, that's an excellent question, and I have thought a bit about that. Not extensively so far. I think when it comes to expression of intentions, we have the same as in this case, where you appeal to intentions for esoteric force. When we have imperative force, it would be something analogous. The compliance with an order or request must then be because of the order or the request, otherwise it's not a compliance, something that happens anyway. So there must be a causal connection.
So are you talking about the connection between the two notions?
You're talking about just the functional part in itself?
Yeah. That's one question, and then start with the functional part in itself.
Yes, so on the... I am not sure about the general case. I think in most cases it goes through that it concerns, maybe in all cases, that concerns the actual world. Again, I might be slightly guided by the appeal to causality. I think here the trickiest case is that of the optative. I express a hope or a desire that something will happen, there is in general no requirement that something will happen because I hope or desire it. So the connection is hard, I think, to forge even indirectly in the case of the optative. So what I have come to think as a possible way of aligning it with the others is that in the typical cases, you would desire to be in a state where you know that the desire has been fulfilled. So that requires two things. One is that the state obtains in the world after, sometimes in the future, and also that the belief or knowledge that it obtains also can be combined with the belief that one had the desire. So the belief or knowledge that it obtains must take place in the same world where the desire occurred. So that's, I think, so far the best I can do. And I think even though one can, in principle, desire for unknowable states to obtain, there is the paradigm case is that one desires for states that one can recognize as obtaining when, if they obtain. However, if a desire is just a desire that some proposition be true, there would be nothing wrong with desiring that it's possible that P, in which case it can be realized because P is true in some other world. So maybe there are restrictions on desires to make them reasonable that restricts desires from having such content. So the short answer is yes, I think we can apply the functional notions to others. It will be in the case of belief, it's direct, and in other cases, I think it has to be indirect there too, like in an order that can only be because of the idea of connection with compliance with the order.
Okay. Can I ask a quick question?
Yep.
If there's actually we have time, so. No, it's clarification about the claim that belief concerns the causal source of information. So I was thinking of cases where the belief is based on a mere hunch, a gut feeling. For instance, you have two farmers, and one says, I feel it's going to rain, and the other disagrees, for instance, but you might say there's no causal connection between the belief and whatever in the world will make true or false the proposition that it's going to rain. And so I was wondering whether you might adapt some these kind of cases to your first case here. So you would have an intuition of disagreement maybe, but one which has nothing to do with the fact that the beliefs share a source of information. My intuition, when you have a mere a belief based on mere hunch or a gut feeling, then there's no causal source of information, or is there?
Well, I wouldn't be alien to answering that the source of information is whatever caused that gut feeling.
Okay.
Even though the... an intrinsic connection in the sense that the description of that cause is intrinsically connected to a description of the feeling.
Or take wishful thinking. I mean, maybe one farmer just wishes that it rain, and so yeah, there's no causal source of information, I guess, for his belief.
Uh, Yeah, so if you ask him why does he think believe that, what will he answer? Not that it's wishful thinking.
No, of course.
So he
will confabulate or
he will think that it's based on something as beliefs are, and so I think one can treat those cases as conforming, even in the weak sense, that there is something in the world that has given rise to this belief, even though that cause doesn't provide any reasonable evidence for the belief.
Okay.
But it's also, I mean, I haven't thought enough about this. Maybe it's not necessary to have a good case for each and every example, each and every instance of a belief, but it should be a principle that covers all the clear cases. Okay. That's a way, an answer which I think also has some merit.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter. This is just a request for clarification. You made appeal to the notion of expression of belief towards the end of your talk, and it's an issue on which I have some feelings, and so
yes.
I wish you could say a little bit about
This was non-technical use, and then in that passage, I think that was just causal. So the assertion is an assertion of something that is believed, and partly because of having the belief. So it's a simple-minded notion of expression.
Expression is just a causal notion.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. At least it in the causal connection is a central part of that expression in that sense.
Got it. So that you could just as well use the word manifestation there, I think.
Yes. Yes. That's right. Yeah.
And so if that's right, then I think it might be difficult to capture at least one aspect of force, or at least the kind of speech act complex in which force is involved, namely what we think of as sincerity conditions. Right? It seems like there's more to expression of belief than just its being an emanation of a state of mind, because we want to say there's a norm there that people are expected to live up to. And that's independent from the claim that most often people do, or something of the sort. Do you feel like you've got a way of handling the normativity of sincerity conditions? Or is that something that you feel is beyond the
I am totally against that. So I wouldn't want to try, even start trying.
Got it.
The norm. I think I am, so the, well, I'm quite open to the idea that speakers have normative convictions, that it's part of, let's say, folk linguistics or folk philosophy speech acts are governed by norms. I would say I would then apply an error theory to mm-hmm. these people, mm-hmm. including maybe many people here. Mm-hmm. But I'm a little more positive to commitment views, in the sense that I think it's right that normally when making an assertion, one does make a commitment, and that's part of human psychology, that's mm-hmm. commitment in the psychological sense. Although I think, for reasons I've argued in other papers, that one can't define assertion in terms of that, because it's not a sufficient condition. Uh-huh. But I think it's at least bordering on being necessary for psychological reasons.
A commitment.
Not for normative reasons or metaphysical reasons.
Got it. So commitment is a necessary condition of something like an assertion, then that is sufficient.
Yes, that's, yeah.
And am I right to think that what you're saying is that once we scrape away the largely confused folk psychology around speech acts and so forth, it's that kind of thing that we'll have left, a sort of refined, conceptually engineered, as it were, version of the notion of a speech act, or at least that of assertion?
Well, I mean, I have a theory about the assertoric force, mm-hmm. where commitment doesn't figure either.
Okay.
I would think that it's part of normal human psychology that whenever speakers make assertions in accordance with my theory, they also are committing themselves. There are counterexamples to that. I mean, bullshitting, for instance, is without commitment. If you look at the obsessive liars, they lie without giving it a second thought. I mean, there are, if you read literature on psychopaths, for instance, which are almost compulsive liars, they just take delight in fooling people and making people believe what's true. There is no sense of commitment at all there. So I think it's just a matter of normal human psychology that people make commitments when making assertions. But what I have argued makes for assertoric force is precisely that it's prima facie informative. That is, the utterance indicates the truth of the proposition uttered. And that's part of the reason. Then you can have other reasons as well. I mean, you don't go around asserting everything you think is true. So there are other things that come in, like relevance and other matters, ideas about need for information.
But I guess my question then would be, how do you distinguish between natural phenomena that are also prima facie informative and utterances that are prima facie informative? Do you want to say that natural phenomena are assertions also?
No.
Okay.
No.
So how would you make that distinction?
I make the distinction between by the fact that the events that are informative have intrinsic content.
Intrinsic content.
Yes.
Okay.
So, for instance, a road sign could be informative. A clock on the wall can be informative. They have intrinsic content. But natural events like fire, like smoke, for instance, does not have an intrinsic content. It's knowledge of causal connections that make you infer that there is fire when there is smoke. So that's the basic dividing line.
Good. What about biological phenomena, such as bright coloration on an Amazonian tree frog or something like that? Because that seems not easily categorizable either as the sign or as the fire. Those are designed to convey information, plausibly, by natural selection.
Well, I would definitely be prepared to say that this is communication. This is a matter of animal communication.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's informative, one would go into discussions of like biosemantics and to see if there is something that one can properly characterize as having an intrinsic content in the coloring of a frog or the position of the ears of a tiger or things like that. And in most cases, I would think I'm inclined to say, no, it's more like a connection between smoke and fire that conspecifics are attuned to. But I think I'm not, as far as I can see now, committed to any particular stance there. So I would be open to arguments in either direction as concerns
animal. Where the notion of intrinsic content falls is going to determine whether it's an assertion made by the
yes. So it's on the content carrying states that can be utterances which have assertoric force. Or not.
But you would not consider it a reductio of your view if it turned out that on some elucidation of intrinsic content, the bright coloration on the tree frog's skin asserts that it's poisonous. I don't mean that as a lampooning.
No, I wouldn't.
Yeah, okay.
I wouldn't. If you can make a good case that it conforms to my theory, I would say I would embrace it.
Mm-hmm. Without blinking.
Good. Maybe with blinking. But
thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
So unless I'm mistaken, there's no question from the virtual audience, but you can write your question as well if you prefer. Okay, so we should thank Peter very much.